fourth case, Covey versus the State Bank of Toulon. Ms. Covey?
May it please the court, I believe the issue in this case is simple. Whether an unambiguous security agreement, which is also a fully integrated security agreement, which states that it secures a debt which never existed, can be reformed with parole evidence as against a subsequent creditor who had no notice of the error. I think the answer is clearly no, it cannot be so reformed. The facts in the case are simple. The debtor signed a security agreement prior to filing bankruptcy, which purported to grant a security interest securing a note that was dated December 13, 2008, in the amount of blank dollars.
You know, many of the cases that you rely on involve an inadequate description of the collateral rather than an inadequate description of the debts to be secured. So can you identify any Illinois case in which the inadequate identification of the debt rendered the security agreement unenforceable?
As I stand here today, I can't think of an Illinois case. I do cite two cases, the Texas Kenworth case and the First State Bank or Safety Bank versus Berman case, which was a First District appellate court case.
That was the First Circuit
U.S. Court of Appeals.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In that case, those cases both involved a misidentification or non-identification of any existing debt. And I would point out that in the bankruptcy court noted that when you're dealing with a uniform law, cases from other jurisdictions are highly persuasive. And the Berman case, there was a security agreement which stated it secured one note, a note dated July 30, 1963, and none other. That note had been paid. The debtor then signed subsequent notes, all of which stated they were secured by the security agreement. Debtor then filed bankruptcy. The court held that the security agreement was no good because it did not incur any existing debt. It was invalid as against the trustee. The court in that case also considered equitable considerations. It said the debtor didn't demand a termination statement of the financing statement. So it seemed to me the court was considering, should we take into account that appears the parties made a mistake here? They intended to secure these debts, but they just didn't say that. And the court said no, using the same rationale as the Martin Grinding case, that to advance certainty in secured transactions, you have to be able to rely on this on what the security agreement says. You have to be willing to, a subsequent creditor has the right to assume that the party that drafted the security agreement said what they meant what they said. And the court dismissed the equitable concerns and did not take those into account.
Those were the fireside equities that Judge Coffin wrote about?
Yes, fireside okay. Equities.
Yeah. Mr. Covey, let me ask you, I want to make sure that I understand sort of the scope of the rule you're arguing for here. If a security agreement has a so-called dragnet clause, that's sufficient to identify any existing debts, and and anybody who sees that is on notice to look around for any debts to that creditor, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. How about if a security agreement does not identify any debt at all? Is that a problem?
Yes, I think if it identifies no debt at all, then that security agreement does not create a security.
Well, suppose it just says, I owe a debt to Toulon State Bank.
And doesn't say
anything more.
No, because a security interest is by definition an interest in personal property which secures an obligation. But also a security agreement is only effective according to its terms. It only does what it says it does. If it doesn't say that a security interest to secure this debt is hereby granted, then no security interest is created in the security agreement. It's got to say that.
Well, I guess I don't see that in the statutes. I understand we say enforce it according to its terms.
Right.
but I don't see an explicit requirement that it identify the debt. Now, your case is different because there's a debt identified and it's a mistake.
Correct. But I think it is necessary to identify. If you don't identify a debt, it doesn't specifically say.
Well, then why doesn't that reasoning say that a dragnet clause is insufficient?
The dragnet clause does identify a debt. It says this collateral secures all debts, and thereby it has identified a debt.
So how about if it just says I owe a debt to the State Bank of Toulon?
You need language. That's
any debt to the State Bank of Toulon.
This secures all
debts. That looks like a dragnet clause.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Would you agree that as between the original lender and borrower, this was a mutual mistake that could justify reformation as between those two parties?
No. It could possibly have been a clerical error. But the reason
for
that
is... I don't understand why you can't concede that.
Well, the reason
because
is...
Because it's an obvious error.
Well, the reason is because the... Mr. Bluenier, who drafted the security interest, testified he's careful and meticulous.
Yeah. So. I mean, he obviously blew it, okay? But if Mr. Duckworth himself, not your client as trustee, but if Mr. Duckworth himself were seeking to get out from under this, then clearly a court would reform this, right?
Well, the problem I have is it has to be clear and convincing evidence. And if I was
Duckworth himself has admitted that this was a mistake.
Well, he admitted that he intended to grant a lien.
Yeah. Okay. Loan that he was getting from the bank, right?
Intended to grant a lien. The note says it's secured by the security agreement. The December 15th note states that it's secured.
Yeah.
I just have a problem with if I'm drafting a security agreement, why wouldn't I put the amount of it in there if I'm trying to specifically? But
was anyway, it sloppy? Yes. Was it a mistake? Yes. But I don't understand why you've got a privileged position here. As trustee, I don't understand why you're fighting about reformation as between the parties.
Well, okay. It's irrelevant to this case. The primary issue in this case is whether it can be reformed as against the trustee.
Let me just ask you I got a very elementary question. What exactly is recorded for public inspection? Is the security agreement itself?
Generally just a financing statement is recorded.
That tells you whom to ask.
Whom to ask, right.
Okay.
And if
you're going to ask that lender, what's so onerous about expecting that you might also ask for to see the documents about the underlying debt?
Well, the court in Martin Grinding says that, and in the Helms case says that the primary document is the security agreement. That is the document that creates the security interest. That's where you start, and that you can also look at the security agreement to determine what obligations are secured. So that's the starting point. They might also send you. Let's say in this case. The bank also sent the December 15th note. But what I start with is the security agreement. Both Helms and Martin Grinding say that. I look at that security agreement and it says it secures a note dated December 13, 2008 and no dollars. I call the bank, how much is owed under that note? Because I have a duty of inquiry, I have a duty to find out how much was owed. Their only response is, there never was such a note. No such note ever existed. That's the end of my inquiry. I have the right to rely on the security agreement that for some reason, I don't know why, they said it would secure this December 13th note. That defines the scope of my inquiry. That's all I'm legally required to do. I'm a hypothetical, imaginary creditor that has every conceivable right. One right is the right to rely on an unambiguous security agreement. Excuse me, and there's no argument that this security agreement is ambiguous. It's very clear. So I wouldn't have even looked at that to say, I don't care about the December 15th note. I don't care about the January 29th note. I don't care about all the purchase money notes. They're not referred to in the security agreement, and I can rely on that.
But even if we consider only the plain language of the ASA, the ASA states, quote, this agreement, together with any related documents, constitutes the entire understanding and agreement of the parties as to the matters set forth in this agreement. Why isn't the reference to related documents, which explicitly includes other notes, sufficient to include within the ASA the contemporaneously executed 2008 note, especially given that the definition of indebtedness in the ASA includes indebtedness that's evidenced by the note or related documents?
Well, you are right, but related documents is not all promissory notes. It's all promissory notes executed in connection with the indebtedness, which is a capital I. And indebtedness is, so you have to go back to look at what is indebtedness. Indebtedness is defined as the note and related documents. So related documents adds nothing. It is a meaningless term. It is circular, as the bankruptcy court found, it's circular, and adds nothing, in my view. Because it refers back, it takes you right back to the December 13th note, which never existed. It doesn't add anything, in my view. So that, the provision that you quoted, related documents, doesn't add anything. It's not all promissory notes. It's all promissory notes executed in connection with the December 13th note. And there couldn't be any notes that were executed in connection with a note that never existed. So I think that the security, well, I see my lights flashing. So
you're, yeah. It's the start of rebuttal, Mr. Covey. So you want to reserve the rest
of
your time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Howard.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Covey. My name is Tim Howard. I represent the State Bank of Toulon, Illinois. My client requests the court affirm the district court orders entered in this case in March of this year. First, my good friend Mr. Covey and I have a deep disagreement, intellectual I suppose, about what the key issue is in this case. I believe that the bankruptcy judge Perkins correctly identified that issue on page 10 of his 2012 opinion, where he said, quote, "A mistake in the description of the secured debt does not render an otherwise valid security agreement unenforceable." And Judge McDade agreed, and so did Judge Shadid, by incorporating Judge McDade's argument or decision. Now, the trustee believes that the agricultural security agreement does not satisfy the enforceability requirements of UCC section 9203B. And he even argues that section doesn't even apply. Well, we take a different approach.
Well, isn't that the problem? I mean, we enforce it according to its terms.
Correct.
Its terms say it secures a debt that doesn't actually exist.
Well, here's how
And so the real problem is parole modification or reformation of the document.
Well, right? I agree with the way Judge Perkins did it in terms about parole, the issue of parole. And let me see if I can do it this way. Section 9203 has three requirements. The first one that's at issue, and the way he talks about it, is debt, but it's a requirement of value given. And so the value given was that almost $1.1 million dispersed on December 15th. So the only way you're going to find out to prove whether you have an enforceable security agreement is you're going to have parole evidence to demonstrate that the value was given.
That can't be right.
Not the note. The note itself is insufficient. You could have a note and never been a disbursement. So you have to have evidence, as we had here in Mr. Brunier's declaration, that he dispersed the funds.
The security agreement should identify the value given, right?
No, I disagree. I don't think it. I think that all that you need to have to have an enforceable security agreement are the three requirements contained in Section 9203B, which are value given, that the debtor had rights in the collateral, that's undisputed, and that it's undisputed that the debtor signed an agricultural security agreement which specifically described the collateral with which a lien was being given on. That's all the law requires.
So can you add a dragnet clause by parole evidence?
No, you cannot, and I think that's the Martin Grinder case. I mean, you can't expand, you can't expand the terms of a security agreement.
Okay,
I agree that
you can't expand the collateral.
You can't expand.
Expand the debts by parole evidence? That would be the dragnet clause, right?
Yeah, I guess my reaction would be if either has a dragnet clause or it doesn't, then you cannot add one. Correct.
That's the safe deposit, right?
Well, in the safe deposit bank case, there, the security agreement identified a specific debt.
Yeah.
And that debt was then paid. Mm-hmm. And then the question was, is the dragnet clause bringing in this new debt? That's not the facts of this case.
It's pretty similar. If you can't, by parole evidence, add a dragnet clause on the theory that, well, we meant to include that, right? You agree with that?
Yeah.
How about, maybe what kinds of errors, I guess, do you think can be corrected by parole evidence in a security agreement? How about misnaming the creditor?
I think each spelling error could be corrected. Let's say you misnamed the creditor, or the person who prepared it, misnamed the debtor. Now, you're going to have problems if they misname the debtor and it's filed on the financing statement, because under the rules with regard to financing statements, you've got to have pretty clear perfection.
Exactly.
But let me give another example, the preparation of loan documents is a human endeavor. Mistakes are made. If the person preparing the loan documents had failed to include the collateral description in the security agreement, that's a fatal mistake. It's a fatal mistake because 9203B requires the collateral description. But it's not a fatal mistake if all you've done is you've identified the date of the note being December 13th when the note was actually dated December 15th.
And well, I think suppose you had the wrong year. I mean, Mr. Covey has given us a number of hypotheticals. The wrong year, the wrong month, is the subsequent lender obliged to figure out all those mistakes?
Well, here's what I think the subsequent lender is obligated to do. I think the subsequent lender is obligated to ask for information, including the security agreement, and information regarding the debt. And to me, it's quite simple. And this is why I think the composite document rule comes into play here.
Okay, the composite document cases, at least that I saw, are all about as between the parties.
Correct.
And
if I can articulate this way, please. And I brought, by the way, the security agreement. I love the digital age, but it's too small to read. It's big.
No kidding.
Yeah. And here's the note. You know, they're on legal size. You're the subsequent creditor. You want to know what the security agreement is. I give you this. You want to know what the debt is. I give you this. Under composite document rule, they're one contract. You read through it. The agricultural security agreement talks about a note dated December 13th. The note talks about the agricultural security agreement dated December 13th. I think when you read it on its face, it's obvious that there was an error. And Mr. Lanier testified he made a clerical error.
Yeah. What obligates the subsequent creditor to look beyond the security agreement?
Because the subsequent creditor wants to know what the debt is that's being secured.
And asks for the identified debt.
Asks for the identified debt.
Is told no note dated December 13th.
No, they're not going to tell them. They're going to do exactly what I did when I asked the bank when the case started. Send me the security agreement and the debt, and you're going to get these two pieces of paper. That's the practical. The law, this is commercial law that deals with practicality and deals with the real world.
It also deals with technicalities, and the Judge Coffin's reasoning in safe deposit against Berman is pretty compelling.
Yes, but again, there the issue was whether or not there was a dragnet clause. There was no issue about whether or not the note executed at the time of the security agreement was secured by that security agreement. There was no question as to whether or not that security agreement wasn't enforceable under 9203 because the three requirements had been met. Here, the note that was executed with the security agreement remains unpaid. And to answer your question, I think, yeah, I could see where you'd have a mistake with regard to the year. We've all seen it when we do it with our checks at the turn of the year. You know, you put the wrong year, you put the last year's, those kind of mistakes I think happen. I can see where there'd be a mistake in the spelling.
Sure, those kinds of mistakes happen, and as between the parties, you've got a perfectly good case for reformation.
Yeah, but I kind of agree with Judge Perkins. I don't think reformation is necessary here because the testimony of the parties is unequivocal that they intended this note and the debt incurred to be secured by this security agreement. And when you read them together, why do the parties need to reform? It's usually reformation is where one side doesn't agree that term should be in there, and you have a dispute. Here the parties agree that this debt is secured by this security agreement. So why do you need reformation? I think that I like that approach better. And
I can imagine you do, but it's a problem. I mean, if Duckworth himself were trying to get out from under this lien, you've got a very solid evidence that this was a mistake, but the problem you've got is that the special status of the trustee. And that takes us to the reasoning of Safe Deposit Bank and Trust against Berman and a few similar cases where there's been a mistake and you've got this hypothetical creditor.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I have to live with the facts I've got. And my facts are not the safety deposit case. I'm talking about a case where the same note executed at the same time the security agreement remains unpaid. In that case, the note had been paid. I'm talking about a case, let me just suggest here also that I agree with the way, because I argued this in front of Judge Perkins and Judge McDade adopted it, that the way that the integration clause requires that the agricultural security agreement and the promissory note be construed together.
You've still got this problem with the circularity of that definition, indebtedness.
I don't disagree that there's a certain circularity, and that's not the way I would have drafted it if they'd asked me. But the fact of the matter is that you're on notice that there are other promissory notes that were executed, and you need to look at those. At least it gives you instruction that there's something more than the security agreement itself that you have to look at. And if the bank gives you the security agreement and this note, and you read them together, are we going to elevate form over substance to say, okay,
in
it's not
commercial
enforceable?
Law? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, only because in 9203B, it requires that the collateral description be contained in there. It doesn't require that there be
specific identification. More generally, we enforce security agreements according to their terms. There's nothing ambiguous about this.
No, I agree. And I think that according to the terms of this security agreement, incorporating the definition of indebtedness and related documents, I think that achieves it. And I agree with the approach that Judge McDade took. Well, let me just conclude. It was my remarks that I always thought this was a simple case. I thought Mr. Blamire's declaration and the was pretty straightforward. He prepared the documents. He didn't have an assistant. He didn't have a loan document person. This is the State Bank of Toulon. He sat down with Mr. Duckworth. He had Mr. Duckworth execute the documents. He dispersed the funds. Both he and Mr. Duckworth testify that this debt is secured by this agricultural security agreement. If the agricultural security agreement is effective, enforceable, because it meets the terms and responsibilities of 9203B, then why should there be a requirement there be a specific identification added to it? Because it's not in the law, it's not in Article 9, it's not in Illinois case law. And I think that should be sufficient in itself. I guess I want to end on that point. If you have any other further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Ms. Covey.
Thank you. Just to address some of the points, whether reformation is necessary, the bank specifically requested that this security agreement be reformed in the bankruptcy court and in the district court brief. It also refers to a mutual mistake, in the security agreement. So the bank has asked for reformation. Clearly this document has to be reformed in order to be effective as against a hypothetical, ideal, imaginary creditor who had no notice of any error. It has to be reformed, or it's not effective. There's one other point that the bank made in its brief is that Judge McDade didn't decide the reformation issue, so therefore this court can't decide it. I think Judge McDade did hold that the agreement was reformable, even though he said it wasn't. But I don't think it matters. Judge McDade specifically held that Martin Grinding does not apply to this case. Should this court overrule Judge McDade on that issue, then the court will have held that the security agreement cannot be modified under any theory, whether it be reformation, latent ambiguity, composite document theory, patent ambiguity. It can't be modified. So there'd be no reason to send it back to Judge McDade to decide reformation because it can't be modified under any theory. The 9203B argument is false because you don't talk about the 9203B says a security interest is enforceable if the three requirements are met. We don't have a security interest securing the 2008 note here because it wasn't created in the document. We never get to 9203B we have no security interests. 9203B refers to collateral. Well, collateral is defined as property that's subject to a security interest. So there's no collateral unless you have a security interest. 9203B refers to a security agreement. The debtor has to sign a security agreement containing a description of the collateral. There's no security agreement because we don't have a document that created a security interest securing the 2008 note. So 9203B is completely irrelevant. If 9203B is correct, then the 2010 note is also secured. Value was given, the debtor has rights in the collateral, he signed a security agreement. Why isn't the 2010 note? The bank admits that's not secured. Well, why isn't it? Why isn't the credit card that the debtor may have had with the bank? Why aren't all debts automatically secured? Why do you need a future advance clause if all you have to do is meet the requirement of 9203B and every debt is secured even if it's not mentioned? Why do you need a dragnet clause? So the 9203B is a non-starter. But the value given argument, yes, the bank did give value to for the December 15th note, but the security agreement doesn't secure that note. That's irrelevant. That's just as irrelevant as that the bank gave value for the 2010 note. Since the security agreement doesn't secure it, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. The composite document theory was specifically rejected in the Martin Grinding case. It cannot be used when there's an unambiguous security agreement, which is also fully integrated. There is no composite document theory. I don't know why we're talking about other documents when we have a complete integrated security agreement here. Also, the bank cites the Tepfer case in support of the composite document theory. The Tepfer case, which is an Illinois case, states that it doesn't apply if there's an inconsistency, a necessary inconsistency in the documents. And that's what we have here. The December 3rd, the security agreement and the note are inconsistent because the security agreement refers to the December 13th note. So that's another reason the composite document theory is inapplicable. The composite document theory relies on parole evidence, and you can't use parole evidence to change the security agreement as against a subsequent creditor who had no notice. Now, Mr. Howard also mentioned we're in the real world. We're not in the real world. We're in a hypothetical world, okay? That I am an ideal imaginary creditor, and I only did what I had the legal requirement to do. That's all I did. I did nothing more than that.
You're in this hypothetical world. the hypothetical creditor would have concluded that the Duckworth and the bank intended to secure nothing. That would be the reading you would have us have.
If I was a hypothetical creditor, I'd look at that. There's no December 13th note. I wouldn't conclude anything. I would simply say there's no security interest securing a note here. Because I have the right, that's well, what reliance
you,
means.
But if I did. Would you conclude that Duckworth and the bank had any commercial relationship from the documents that are.
From just the security interest? From the security agreement, no, they had no relation because there's no promissory note. But if I did think about it, what I would have, which I don't think I had to, I'd have said they didn't make that loan. The December 13th loan didn't go through. I don't know why it didn't go through. I don't care why it didn't. Maybe he went to another bank and gave him a mortgage. I mean, I don't care. If you start making me wonder about things, then there's no certainty. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Covey. Thank you, Mr. Howard. The case is taken under advisement. The court